Anyway, you'll give it to them as if some idiot goes to Syria to get your kid. She regarded him for a long time, then snorted out an angry laugh.
What? You will just fly into Damascus, knock on the gate to my house, and ask the guards if you can take my baby for a drive?
Think that would work? Bianca did not smile, but her chin rose, her eyes widened.
Do you really think you can do this?
I have a plan.
It had better be a good one.
Well, the quality of it will improve the moment I get some idea where I'm going. Now she wiped her face, brought her hair back behind her ears, and sat up even more. Court saw that the woman felt she was being teased with a lifeline, but she felt her own actions now were the only way to encourage the man across from her to toss it her way.
Sir, I am begging you to do this. What do you want from me?
They talked in general about the layout of her house and the habits of the guards there, but Bianca did not tell Court the exact location, only the district of the city she lived in. Court suspected he understood why, but when he asked her outright for her address, his suspicion was confirmed. Medina looked down to the floor for nearly a minute. Finally, she said,
I will tell you where Jamal is being kept once you get to Damascus. If you are caught at the border, you might give up information under torture. I can't let Ahmed know I'm helping the people who've kidnapped me. If he knew that, he would definitely kill my son.
Court realized this would make his job more difficult, but he also realized this was the right move for Bianca to make. It made Jamal a little bit safer, and it put Court at more risk. If he had been the boy's parent, he would have done exactly the same thing. I understand. Court stood, but Bianca said,
How do you plan on traveling with a 4-month-old?
Court cocked his head. He didn't really understand the question.
I'll just carry him, I guess. How much can he possibly weigh?
Bianca closed her eyes. Suddenly, Court could see disappointment on her face.
You haven't even thought about this, have you?
Full disclosure. I've never snatched a baby before. This will be a first.
Do you have children?
When she didn't get an answer, she said,
No. You wouldn't, would you?
She sighed.
Well, I can tell you one thing. You can't do this alone. He needs food, care. You don't look like someone who can take care of a baby.
Court just stared back at her.
His au pair is there. She is with him all the time, and she can take care of him until you bring him to me. Her name is Yasmin. She will help you.
Why would she help me?
Bianca said.
She will have no choice. Azam would have her killed in an instant if Jamal disappeared while she was with him, and she knows that. If you take my baby, Yasmin will come with you.
Okay.
Sir, you hold Jamal's life in your hands, as you do Yasmin's, as you do mine.
No pressure, thought Court.
He began to stand, but she reached out and put a hand on his leg.
I lied to the Halabis.
Court sat back down.
Lied?
I told them I knew nothing about Ahmed's movements. It's not true. I know things.
Why are you telling me this? I didn't ask you any-
I know about a trip he will be taking soon.
A trip? Out of Syria?
She shook her head quickly.
No. Other than our trip to Tehran, he hasn't left Syria in years. He rarely even leaves Damascus. But he will leave the capital this time. He is going to review his troops at some bases. Then he is going to a new Russian base somewhere.
Why?
The Crown Prince of Jordan spends time in the field with his troops. Shakira told Ahmed this makes him look strong, so Ahmed will do it too. And this new Russian base. I think something is special about it. He said he wanted to be there to bask in the glory. But I don't really know what he meant by that. This is all top secret, but Ahmed told me about it to impress me, and to tell me he wouldn't be by to see his child for a few days.
So you don't know where he's going? Court asked.
She shook her head.
No, but he did tell me when. He leaves next Monday. He will be gone until Tuesday.
Any chance he'll cancel his trip now that all of this is going on with you?
No chance. He would have to explain himself to the Russians, and he won't do that. No, he will go.
Thank you, Court said. I'll talk to you again when I'm in theater and in play. She climbed off the little bed and went to her knees, then hugged Court tightly while he sat on the chair. Tears dripped from her long lashes now.
Please don't forget. My son is counting on you.
Court took her by the upper arms and separated the two of them a little. He looked into her eyes.
He's counting on you too, Bianca. Because when I do get back here with the kid, you better start singing to the Halabis. They've seen their country destroyed, 500,000 killed, their own 2 children blown to bits. Chemical weapons used on their friends. They are desperate. For your sake and theirs. You need to give them what they want.
Monsieur, if you bring me back my Jamal, I will do anything I can possibly do to help them end Ahmad and Shakira's rule.
Chapter 22 Court climbed the stairs and stepped back into the living room, and there he saw the Halabis sitting and drinking tea with Vincent Voland. All three looked up to him. While Voland's face was as impassive as only a veteran intelligence operative could make it, the Halabis could not hide their hopes and expectations. Court said,
Surely you are all aware that Shakira Azam is going to send people up here to try and find and kill Bianca.
Voland said, I've told the Halabis about Sebastian Drexler, the man who called himself Eric. Obviously, he controls members of the local police force. I think it likely he will come himself now that his earlier attempts have failed.
What about Ahmed Azam's men?
Voland said, French intelligence is watching the Syrian embassy here in Paris closely. We know who the GIS people are. Of course, they have non-official cover operatives, not working at the embassies, and those men we can't track.
Are they any good?
They aren't bad. One of their number, an operative who used the codename Malik, killed 4 federal police officers in Belgium last year. There have been assassinations in Paris, but only of Syrians in exile. We don't see them being able to put any numbers of non-official cover operatives together, and if they did, there is no way they could find us here at this safe house. A man like Drexler, perhaps he could find us. He is well-connected throughout Europe, intelligent, and deeply cunning.
Voland smiled a little.
The good news is we know Drexler won't be working with Syrian government assassins. He's essentially on the opposite mission as they are.
Court said, But if Drexler comes to this house, he won't come alone.
Voland nodded.
He'll put together some sort of force, yes. And the Syrians here protecting Bianca, while committed to the cause, aren't particularly skilled. I am reaching out to an old friend who can help with security.
Tarek said,
We'll keep the woman safe, but our operation will only succeed if she talks.
Court knew what he was suggesting.
Yes, Tarek. I will go to Syria to get the kid and his nanny.
Rima said,
This is wonderful news. I can talk to our connections immediately.
It will take them up to a week to get you the papers you need to pose as medical staff.
I'm not waiting a week. I'm not posing as a doctor. And I'm not using your connections. I'll make my own way in.
Your own way?
Tarek almost shouted it.
Are you crazy?
Vincent Voland looked stunned.
You speak fluent Arabic? Just enough to get myself into trouble, actually.
Tarek asked,
But then, how are you?
I'm going to leave here, and then in a few days, I will contact you from Damascus. That's all you need to know. When I call, you will put Bianca on the phone, and she will give me directions to where I need to go to get her kid. Once I have the kid and the nanny, I will make a run for the border.
Rima and Tarek looked at each other.
Tarek said,
Lebanon is to the west. Lebanon is Hezbollah, which means it's almost as dangerous for you as Syria.
Right, Court said. Scratch that.
Rima added,
To the north is Turkey, and the border is easy to cross, but that's a long way from Damascus.
Plus, ISIS owns 5 times the territory the Americans, Kurds, and Free Syrians do. And it's a fluid battlefield.
I'll pass, Tarek said.
To the east is Iraq, 300 kilometers distant, inhospitable terrain, and the war is being fought there as well. Eastern Syria is populated with ISIS fighters, and then, if you did make it into Iraq, it's another 500 kilometers of desert to civilization,
where I would find more people who probably wouldn't mind killing me.
It's very possible.
Yeah. No.
Voland said, That's why south is your best option. It's a 5-hour drive to the Jordanian border from Damascus. There will be checkpoints along the way, which you'll have to avoid on your own. But once at the border, I have contacts in the Jordanian intelligence services who can get all 3 of you across.
Court asked, Why would they do that?
They don't know who you are, and they don't know who Bianca is. But they know who I am, and they trust me. When they learn that getting 3 people over the border is the way to cause a split in the relationship between Russia, Syria, and Iran, they will be willing to help without question.
Court nodded. Jordan it is.
Tarek stood up now, put his arm on Court's shoulder. Court wished people would just stop touching him. The Syrian said,
If I were younger, stronger, faster, if I were trained.
He gave Court a little smile.
If I were you. If I were you, I'd go in there, and I wouldn't return until I was dead, or until Azam himself was dead.
Let's not get carried away. I go in for the baby and the nanny. I get them, find a way south down the Jordanian border, and get out of the country. That's it.
Tarek reached a hand out now.
We thank you for what you are going to do.
Court took Tarek's hand and said, Save your gratitude for when I get back. I might get popped at the border at a roadside checkpoint. My cover might get compromised and I could get tortured to death in a prison before I get within 20 clicks of that kid.
Rima stood and put her hand on Court's face, looking up at him with warm eyes.
Most people just don't care. The fact that you care enough to try makes you someone worthy of my respect. My nation needs your help, monsieur. I've seen so many people die in my hands in the past 7 years.
Me too, Court thought.
But while she was thinking about those she'd lost on the operating table, he was thinking about those he'd killed. In the car on the way back to Paris, Vincent Voland drove in silence. Court could tell something was on his mind.
What is it? He asked.
The Frenchman said,
Their lobbies might not be battle-worn resistance leaders, but they do have contacts in Damascus, and you are making a mistake not using them to get into the country and get around.
Court said, You think I'm going to trust a network of theirs?
No.
If I go in, I go in with my own resources.
Again, I must ask, what resources do you have in Damascus?
Court didn't answer.
There was no need to tell Voland anything else about his plan to get in. Instead, he pivoted.
You need to help them with Bianca and the safe house. With guys and guns, yes, but they also need training. Their tradecraft is non-existent, and you can be damn sure that if Sebastian Drexler comes here, he'll be ready for a bloody fight.
Voland said, We will be prepared for him if he finds us here. I have 4 men joining us, all ex-Foreign Legion, masters in weapons and tactics. These 4, along with the 6 armed Syrians here on the property, mean we will be ready for anything.
Court hadn't liked the layout of the property at all from a defensive standpoint. The woods all around would make it easy for infiltrators to get close to the farmhouse, and he had only noticed the 1 way into Bianca's room in the basement. This made retreat impossible. But all he could do was hope the men Voland said he was bringing in would take steps to minimize the problems with the location. Something else was bothering Court, so he changed gears.
What aren't you telling me?
What do you mean?
Asked Voland. There are parts of your story I'm not buying. The handler in Monte Carlo, for instance. You went to him to find someone to grab Bianca, and he told you he just happened to have access to the Gray Man.
Voland shrugged his shoulders.
Not exactly. When you first contacted him and established your bona fides, he came to French intelligence. They notified me.
French intelligence again, Court said. They seem to be more involved in all this than even the Halabis.
Volan simply said, As I have told you many times, I am not directly affiliated with any agency of any nation. But my contacts have been very helpful in my work with the Halabis. Remember, if Sebastian Drexler comes up here looking for Bianca, a lot of agencies around the world will be happy.
They'll be happy only if you kill him, Court corrected.
Voland made a face of displeasure. We do not have the death penalty here, like you do in America. If he comes up here, our intelligence services will pass the information on to the Police Nationale, who will simply try to arrest him.
Court said, From what I know of the guy, he won't go down without a fight.
D'accord. Agreed, said Voland.
Too bad I'll be out of town.
To this, Voland smiled gravely.
Yes, too bad indeed.
After a few seconds, Voland added,
Maybe you should stay here, not go to Syria.
What are you talking about?
I can pressure Bianca to work with us. We can tell her you have gone and are working on getting her son back. We can salvage something out of the Medina operation, and you can help us with Drexler.
You sound concerned suddenly about how much trouble Drexler can cause here.
It's not that. I am concerned about your chances in Syria. I know your reputation, but still, you are going into a war with many sides, and you have no side of your own.
Court said, I have to see this through. For all their failures in this operation, the Halabis are good people, and their cause is honorable. And from what I can tell, I'm the only good guy in the Halabi's corner.
Voland made an annoyed face.
Present company excluded?
Hardly.
The Frenchman sighed.
Then let me talk to my former counterparts at DGSE, Foreign Intelligence. If you don't trust the Free Syria Exile Union to support your operation, perhaps you will let someone with more experience provide you with assistance while you are down there.
Court just stared out the window. You're forgetting one thing.
What is that?
I don't like you, Voland. You're the asshole who sent me in on top of an ISIS operation. And I don't even trust people I do like, so there is no way I'm going to have you or the DGSE working as my handler on an operation down in Syria.
So you are just going to Syria on your own?
I'll be on my own no matter what anyone promises me. Better for me if I go in with that knowledge than thinking you're up here holding on to my lifeline.
Mon ami, it is clear that you do, in fact, have serious trust issues.
Yeah. I wonder why.
Chapter 23 Police Judiciaire Captain Henri Sauvage had gotten cold feet about all this shit. He hadn't said anything to his partner yet, but he had decided to walk away from all the money he'd been promised, to settle for the money he'd already been paid, and to get the fuck out of Paris. As far as Sauvage was concerned, Eric, the shadowy voice on the phone who'd hired him to find and stalk men and women on behalf of Syrian interests here in Paris, could go to hell. Sauvage's division of the police judiciaire was the Criminal Brigade, known around Paris as La Crime. And they did have a counter-espionage group, but Sauvage wasn't on it. He worked instead in the homicide division. But even though he wasn't a spy or a spy hunter, he understood the concept of MICE. MICE was the acronym for the four principal forms of compromise used by intelligence officers: money, ideology, compromise, and ego. And even though Sauvage wasn't trained professionally on the techniques, he recognized that the man he only knew as Eric had roped him into this mess by using three of the four on him to great effect. Henri Sauvage had no ideology whatsoever. He was in it for the dough. But the other three motivations had brought him to where he found himself today. Money was easy to see. This was why he had agreed to work for Eric in the first place. But looking back on it now, he realized the man had played on his ego as well, by making him feel important enough to recruit three other men in the force to help him. After this was done, Sauvage, Clément, Allard, and Foss continued taking payoffs to provide information to help the Syrians in Paris. First, providing information out of Criminal Brigade databases. Eventually,
Eric upped the ante with footwork, having on Rihanna's boys tail men and women, Syrian expatriates, rebels, and reporters, speaking out against the Azam regime. It was not long before the stakes were raised for the cell of police officers, when one of the Syrian immigrants they had been tailing simply disappeared. Sauvage and his group knew good and well the man they'd surveilled had likely been assassinated, and by this time they had worked out that they were proxy operatives of the Syrian regime. But the four kept at it. Their standards of living had risen, and with this rise came the need for more and more money to fuel their lifestyles. Plus, the missing man had not been a French citizen or well-connected, so no real attention was paid to the event, and Sauvage and his team got away with it scot-free. Over the next year, they were involved in two other operations that appeared to have led to assassinations, but Sauvage's cell was still only involved in hands-off work on the fringes of the operations, so the four men remained compartmentalized from any real danger to themselves, their liberty, or even their careers. But then, the ante was upped again when the mysterious Eric ordered them to follow a Spanish model named Bianca Medina while she visited the city to work at Fashion Week and to report on the security around her. This, Sauvage had known instantly, was a very different animal from all their other work for the Syrians. Every fiber of the captain's being had been against this, and his three partners in crime pushed back as well. But by then, the compromise was in play. Eric had enough dirt on the French cops to put them all in prison, so there was no way they would not comply. Plus, Eric insisted that, as always, their input in the operation would be relatively minor. So they did as ordered, followed the Spanish model, surveilled the location where she was staying, and passed on the information to Eric. And in the process, they became fully involved in the high-profile terrorist massacre that took place in central Paris 3 nights earlier. Now the four police officers were in it up to their necks, and when Foss and Allard had been gunned down 2 days earlier in the apartment of Syrian expatriates, who themselves were now missing, the tension on the two remaining members of the cell of dirty cops was ratcheted up to 10. And that tension had become unbearable for Henri Sauvage. He'd decided to take his family and run, at least for a while. He knew that when he did leave town, Eric would probably go through with his threat to reveal his involvement in the ISIS attack, but Sauvage told himself Eric had no direct proof, and Sauvage could explain the accusation away by constructing an elaborate explanation that Eric was a confidential informant he'd been running off book, who had now turned against him because of an unrelated disagreement. It was a gamble, but less so, Sauvage determined, than continuing the hunt for Bianca Medina and standing by while more people were slaughtered across the city. So, Sauvage decided to hit the bricks, but he could not just leave his partner behind to deal with this alone. To make his escape from his problem, he needed to sell André Clément on the idea of running out on Eric as well. To this end, he'd asked Clément to meet him at a location where they often met confidential informants for clandestine meetings, the car park Stalingrad garage next to the Gare du Nord train station. 5 minutes before 1 a.m., an exhausted and on edge Henri Sauvage drove down the ramp and into the underground garage, parked his little but speedy Renault 308 with the front grille facing the exit ramp, and sat there in the nearly full but perfectly quiet garage while he texted Clément. Où êtes-vous? Where are you? Sauvage had smoked half a cigarette before the reply came. 2 minutes. 2 minutes. Soon, Clément's four-door Citroën rolled down the ramp, and Sauvage flashed his lights. The Citroën turned his way and began rolling forward. Behind it, a pair of sedans also rolled down the ramp. One turned to the left and one to the right, and they disappeared in the massive garage. The Citroën parked in the closest space, just a few spots from Sauvage, so the captain and cell leader got out of his car, left the door open, and strolled over with his walkie-talkie in his hand. He tossed his cigarette, stepped to the driver's side window of the vehicle as it slid down, and leaned down to talk to his old friend. And that was when he realized something was very wrong. 33-year-old André Clément faced forward, his hands gripping the wheel so tightly his fingers were white. and only then did Sauvage see the man in the back seat with a pistol pressed against the back of Clement's head. André Clement looked up at his partner with eyes filled with dread now.
I am sorry, Henri. I couldn't take it, so I tried to run out on this shit. I was going to leave it behind, pack up the kids and just...
Without warning, an ear-splitting crack battered Sauvage's senses. Clement's head snapped forward inside an arc of flame. Blood splattered the inside of the windshield and the steering wheel, but Sauvage did not wait to check on his partner's condition. Instead, he spun away, ducked down as low as he could, and sprinted back around to his Renault. He dove through the open door and fired up his engine, not quite sure what the hell was going on, but damn sure he needed to get the hell out of there. But just as he shifted gears to race from his space, a Ford van that had been parked in the garage shot in front of him on his left to cut him off. The van had no lights on, but Sauvage could see a man in the front passenger seat spin towards him with a short-barreled submachine gun. The two sedans that had entered the garage a minute earlier appeared with squealing tires, shooting forward toward Sauvage. The captain only now went for the weapon he kept in a shoulder holster, palmed the grip of the HK pistol, and started to yank it free. But looking around, he could see a half dozen guns either pointing at him already or moving into position to do so. Henri Sauvage released his grip on the weapon and raised his hands. His car door flew open and he was yanked out by a man with olive skin, wearing a gray denim jacket and jeans. And the man pushed Sauvage forward and through the sliding door of the van, onto a floor covered in plastic tarp. Other men jumped into the van with him. He could hear and feel them more than see them while facing down on the plastic. The vehicle squealed its tires again as it headed off. Sauvage had a knife in his left boot, but it was found by one of the men on top of him now. He wondered at first if they were federal police or intelligence officials. That would make sense, of course, considering his peripheral involvement in an ISIS operation in Paris, but it certainly did not explain why they just executed André in cold blood. But when he was pulled up into a seated position, pushed against the side wall of the van, he got a better look at the four men in the back with him.
"Who the fuck are you?"
Sauvage asked, but he was pretty certain he knew now. They were all Arab. He assumed they were Syrian nationals, living in Europe but serving as either intelligence operatives or contract operatives for the Azam regime. These men had been sent by Eric, and they'd be killers, each and every one. When he and his partners in his side job for the Syrians followed someone who soon disappeared, these were likely the boys who did the disappearing. But there was a modicum of good news for Sauvage. These men hadn't killed him yet, so even though he was sitting on a tarp that looked like it had been put there to catch his flying brain matter, he felt like he retained some ability to affect events. All he had to do was talk to these guys and say exactly the right things, and he would be able to save his life. The man closest to the front of the van wore a black turtleneck, and his black hair was curly, longer than the others. He was somewhere in his late 30s, and he wore a Beretta pistol in a black leather shoulder holster. Sauvage could see a confidence and authority in the man's face, and he decided this was the man to talk to.
"Do you speak French?"
"Yes, you may call me Malik."
He said it in a commanding tone that convinced Sauvage he'd made the right decision to address him.
"All right, Malik. I take it you're in charge?"
"Oui."
"Why did you kill André?"
"He was planning on leaving town. We worried you were thinking about doing the same. We could not let either of you go."
Sauvage leaned closer to the man and pushed some outrage into his voice, even though fear was the predominant emotion going through him right now.
"I'll ask it again. Why did you kill André?"
"Eric ordered us to sacrifice your partner to teach you a lesson."
Now Malik leaned in towards Sauvage and adopted a similar angry tone.
"Have you learned that lesson, Captain Sauvage?"
The Frenchman leaned back against the wall of the van. They were driving around, making left and right turns, and Sauvage had no idea where they were heading.
"What the fuck do you guys want?"
"We want you to fulfill your responsibilities to us. Your work with the police will be crucial in the next days as we hunt for Bianca Medina. We need her alive, unharmed, and we need your help for this."
"I can't help you, man. She's probably long gone from France."
Malik shook his head.
No. The group that has her, the Free Syria Exile Union, is based here. They are being supported by a former French intelligence officer named Voland, who also lives here and has worked here much of his professional life. All signs point to the fact that they are still in the area.
Savage said,
If you have all this information, what the hell do you need me for?
Malik surprised Savage with a shrug.
I do not know. Eric has demanded we take you alive, encourage you not to try to run away, and give you something to do before he comes here himself.
Wait. Eric is coming here?
Tomorrow.
From Syria?
I do not know where he is now.
And what is it I'm supposed to do?
Simple. Find the girl.
Savage sighed.
Clomar was holding a low-level operative in the FSEU at his farm near Versailles. This man, Ali Safra, didn't seem to know anything when we questioned him the other day. But perhaps we could talk to him again?
No, Malik said. We just came from there. He knew nothing about where they are now.
How can you be so sure?
Because he died without telling us, and it did not appear that he much wanted to die.
That sank in for a moment. Sauvage slammed the back of his head against the wall of the van in frustration. He knew there would be no getting away from these men, and they wouldn't leave till they had Bianca Medina in hand. He decided he'd better work with them to get this done fast, so they could get out of his life of treason against his nation.
How many men do you have here in Paris?
Malik did not answer, and when he did, he equivocated.
I have enough.
Come on, Savage said. I need to know your manpower. We will have people to tail, locations to monitor. I have all the intel from the police judiciaire, but it's only me now. I need help to cover known FSEU locations to find the woman.
Malik still did not speak. Savage could tell he wasn't used to handing over information about his force.
Look, man, I don't want to have to go to Eric and put you in the crosshairs.
That did the trick. Even though Malik was in charge, it didn't seem like he wanted to cross swords with Eric.
There are 14 of us, all paramilitary and intel operations trained. We've been pulled from work all over the continent. This includes a 3-man unit of communications specialists with equipment capable of jamming mobile phones and internet.
14, Savage nodded. That's a lot of guns.
What is your plan to find the woman?
Malik asked. Sauvage's actual plan had been to run for his life, but he wasn't going to tell Malik that. Instead, he said,
I have gone back to images we have of Free Syria Exile Union personnel for the last few years. Public events, photos on social media, images captured by police or other cameras around the Halabis. From this, we are identifying members who were associated with them back before they were involved with the rebellion itself. We can put tails on all the main players to see where they go, who they meet with.
Malik said,
That could take time. We need to know where to go by the time Eric gets here.
Savage cocked his head a little.
This guy, Eric, what's his connection to Syria?
I do not know. What I do know is that he has the power to order assassinations on behalf of the regime. That's enough for me to know to do what I'm told. If you are smart, this will be enough for you too.
The van began to slow. The door was opened on Sauvage's right. Malik cocked his head towards the door.
That is all.
The vehicle jolted to a stop now.
We are giving you one chance to survive this, unlike your 3 associates. Find the woman, or find us someone who can lead us to the woman. Do it quickly, or Ahmed Azam himself will order your death.
Sauvage's knees went weak, but he fought through the sensation and climbed out of the van. He found himself back in the parking garage next to his Renault, and as the van rolled off, he saw that both Clement's body and his vehicle had disappeared without a trace. Chapter 24. Lars Klausner didn't go anywhere without his bodyguards. It wasn't that he was particularly paranoid by nature, no. It was that people actually were trying to kill him. Munich is a statistically safe city, safe for most everyone not named Lars Klausner. But the 47-year-old German had spent 2 decades cultivating a reputation that necessitated the 4 German and Austrian ex-special forces close protection detail who moved in box formation around him whenever he was in public. And the armored Mercedes G65 utility vehicle that rolled along nearby, driven by an armed driver, in constant radio contact with the detail. It was past midnight now, and Klausner had spent Friday evening at his regular table at Zum Dornbrau, a traditional German restaurant that began its life as an inn in the 15th century. After dinner and drinks, he enjoyed an evening walk through the city center, and he pretended that he was just one of the crowd, even though his mates were actually his bodyguards, and his silver Mercedes rolled along behind, ready to swoop in and cocoon the big German within 2 inches of steel armor, then race him out of the area. The list of people wanting to end Klausner remained fluid. Right now, he was aware of 2 contracts on his life, but his feelings would be hurt to learn there weren't at least 2 or 3 more. As he walked through the crowded Marienplatz in the city center, this cool and clear Friday evening, he certainly didn't appear to be a man who needed any more security than anyone else in the square. He had a Santa-like beard and a massive Santa-like belly, and though he was obviously a middle-aged man, he was dressed like a German hipster. A designer hoodie and a 2,500-euro puffy jacket, 1,600-euro eyeglasses, and a red knit cap that made him look like he was posing for a catalog that sold adventure wear to those who had never sniffed a whiff of adventure in their lives. Although he didn't stand out as a dangerous individual, Klausner was a man who had forged great success in the industry of violence. He ran a network of security experts that performed all manner of military training on 4 continents, from Bolivia to Gabon, from Guyana to Niger, from Indonesia to Yemen. Klausner Weltausbildungs GmbH provided top-flight private military instruction to anyone who could pay. With training on anything from basic firearms handling all the way up to battalion-sized field tactics, KWA mercenaries stood ready to train the armies, rebel groups, and private security forces of the world. Klausner's company did not field hitmen or spies per se. His was not, on the surface anyway, a cloak-and-dagger outfit. But his specialty was dealing with nations and organizations that had difficulty securing high-quality instruction cadres from abroad because of issues of politics, corruption, or human rights abuses. And there was an especially shadowy side to Klausner's operation that did not show up in the accounting books. It was known by all who hired KWA to train or lead their troops that the foreign mercs they employed could be offered off-hours work in a covert direct action realm. If one worked as an employee of KWA, one knew that his contract might have him training or organizing paramilitary forces in El Salvador or cold-blooded rebel marauders in South Sumatra, but he also knew he might also moonlight running black ops in these war zones himself. KWA's stable of talent was well paid. But most people who worked for the German security firm didn't do so because it was their first choice. Instead, most KWA employees worked there because they were encumbered by something that kept them from being employed at one of the upper-tier security companies around the world. They had criminal convictions. They had been tossed out of other organizations for violating rules of engagement, or they fought drug or alcohol addictions. Or else, they were just evil. Boiled down to its essence, Lars Klausner was a bad guy who contracted bad guys to go fight for and train bad guys. His was a closed loop of dirty. After his walk through the center of Munich, Lars Klausner and his security turned onto Max Joseph Strasse and then entered the vestibule of an ornate apartment building. They were buzzed in by the lobby guard, and then the entourage headed for the elevator. Outside, on their right, the silver Mercedes rolled into a large, lighted garage, and the garage door closed quickly behind it. While the driver parked and shut down his vehicle, a private elevator took Klausner and his detail up to his vast 3rd-floor penthouse, and here, The protectee waited in the hallway with a pair of his men, while the other two checked out his living quarters to make sure it was safe to leave their boss alone for the night. After the all-clear, Klausner stepped into his private quarters, while his security men retired to their end of the penthouse, took off their leather coats, and unslung their weapons. They pulled earpieces out of their ears, and only then did they relax. The chatting came instantly and easy, and when the driver of the Mercedes arrived a few minutes later, all five of them grabbed beers, called their wives and girlfriends, and began watching an FC Bayern soccer match they'd recorded during the week. In his quarters, Klausner turned on his stereo, undressed, and took a hot shower. Afterwards, he toweled off and wrapped his rotund frame in his robe. He'd just begun brushing his teeth when he looked up into the mirror over the vanity. Something moved in the low-lit bedroom behind him. Lars Klausner looked harder into the mirror, the toothbrush hanging from his mouth, and he saw a figure in black leaning against the far wall of the bedroom. The man held a suppressed pistol in his right hand against his thigh, business end down. The man's left hand rose, he held something in it. Suddenly, the music stopped. The man by the wall tossed the stereo remote onto the bed. The toothbrush came out, the German spit and washed his mouth out with bottled water, and he spit that out too. He looked back into the mirror at the man standing there in the dim light. Klausner turned around slowly, facing the figure in the darkness.
Wer sind Sie?
Who are you?
Speak English, Lars.
The German flicked his eyes to the door.
I have bodyguards, you know.
Yeah, is that what you call them?
Klausner's face twitched a little. The door remained closed. There was no sound of footsteps rushing up the hall.
Dead?
He asked.
Nah,
the figure replied.
Just oblivious. You can call out to them if you want to, but you really don't want to.
The man with the American accent stood by a light switch. To Klausner's surprise, he reached over and flicked the switch with the tip of the suppressor of his pistol. Several lamps in the room turned on simultaneously. The German blinked hard again.
Mein Gott! Violator! Is that you?
Court Gentry used the tip of his Gemtek suppressor to flip the lights back off, enshrouding himself and Klausner again in the dim.
No one calls me that anymore.
Ah, yes. Now you are the gray man.
The skin on the heavy German's face suddenly looked almost as white as his beard.
How did you get in?
Court had slipped in through the garage behind the Mercedes, then knelt behind the vehicle, removed his shoes, and crammed them in his backpack while the driver turned off the engine and climbed out. He'd followed the driver up the three flights of stairs, staying one floor behind him on the ascent, and timing his soft footfalls so he'd remain undetected. When the driver unlocked the back door to Klausner's penthouse, Court began racing up the stairs on his stocking feet, pulling a folded envelope from his back pocket as he went. The driver entered the hallway, and the hydraulic closer began pushing the door closed behind him. Court was rushing to the other side of the door, still silent, but taking the stairs three at a time now. Just as the door met the door frame, Court slid down onto his knees on the landing and shoved the envelope forward between the latch in the door and the strike plate in the door jamb. The thick folded paper impeded the automatic latch from slipping into the strike plate mortise and locking the door, and this prevented the door from locking when it closed. Court breathed a sigh of relief. He'd made it with barely a tenth of a second to spare. The latch clicking into place makes a distinctive sound, and this door had not clicked, so Court knew there was a chance the driver on the other side of the door might return to investigate. He reached across his body with his left hand, drew his pistol upside down, and held it that way towards the door right in front of his face. He waited for a minute, but the door he held unlocked did not open, and the driver did not return. So eventually he stood slowly and quietly, and he opened the door just enough to look into the hall. The hall was clear, and Court was inside Klausner's penthouse. But he didn't tell Klausner any of this now. When he did not answer the question of how he got in, Klausner said,
Ah, yes. A magician never reveals his secrets.
After a pause, the German spoke in a grave tone.
There are only two reasons you would show up in my house. Either you have come looking for work, or...
Court replied,
I'm not here for the other reason. Klausner let his relief be known with a heave and a long sigh. He put his hand on his heart for a second. Court thought he was joking, feigning a heart attack, but from the look of the big man, he didn't know if he might in fact have been having some sort of cardiac episode. Klausner lowered his hand with a smile, however, then stepped into the bedroom with his hands away from his body. He moved laterally along the wall and lowered himself down to a settee.
How long has it been? 4 or 5 years?
It was Ankara. You were a burned agency asset, working freelance if memory serves. You didn't have your nickname yet.
A simpler time, Court choked without smiling.
For you, maybe. A team I sent to Turkey had just lost a contract because the man they were protecting was assassinated right under their noses.
Klausner looked around.
Circumstances not unlike this, actually. I found out who did it and offered you a job because I saw what you were capable of. I actually thought I might dip a toe into the contract killer industry.
Court did not reply. Klausner waved his hand.
You took one look at my operation.
Klausner laughed now.
And you kept on walking. Not your cup of tea, as the English say. You found me immoral, dishonorable.
Like I said, a simpler time. The German considered this, then bobbed his head towards a stocked mirrored bar along the wall.
Kaffee or drink?
Nein, danke.
If you aren't here to kill me, we can party all night.
I'm looking for work. Something to get me out of Europe quickly and quietly. Something that pays.
I've never had a job applicant show up in my bedroom with a suppressed Glock in his hand.
I couldn't be sure if you still held a grudge about Ankara.
I'm a businessman, Violetta. That was business, he shrugged. And if you want to work for me now, that's business too.
Any openings?
Klausner raised an eyebrow. As much as I'd love to employ you, I must admit, the fact that you killed your last employer in St. Petersburg gives me a moment's pause.
Not true.
Not true that you killed him? Not true that it was in St. Petersburg? Or not true he was your last employer?
When Court said nothing, Klausner shrugged.
Whatever, no harm done. Gregor Sidorenko was a madman. Bad for the security industry at large. I'm glad you slaughtered him.
He added, I just hope killing the boss isn't your new trademark. Court holstered his suppressed pistol under his jacket.
And they also say everything that happened in Washington, D.C. a couple of months ago was you. All the attacks and killings there.
Sounds like someone is giving me too much credit.
The German smiled again. And this time it did not fade. That's a good line. But the problem is, I do know some of the things you've done in the past. So I know you are one of the few out there who actually lives up to his hype.
I'm here looking for work. So far be it from me to discourage you from your belief that I'm a superhero.
The German laughed harder than before. It's nice to see you again. Wasn't at first, I must say. Who wants to meet the Grim Reaper in the bathrobe?
I've got to get off the continent, Court stressed. I'm willing to go anywhere as long as I can get out of here.
Lars Klausner looked at the American with a curious eye now. What have you gotten yourself into?
Court stood silently against the wall.
Right. None of my business. Let me think. A job in Caracas just fell into my lap. It's not your speed, really. A little simplistic for you. Small arms training for a rebel outfit that's in need of some...
Court interrupted him. Think bigger.
The German did so. Ukraine?
I said out of Europe. Ukraine is in Europe, Lars.
That it is. Just thought you might want to see Kiev again.
Court didn't blink at this reference to his past, and Klausner let it go.
The German rubbed his thick cheeks. Well, there is something else, but you'd have to get your hands dirty. Very dirty. The Violator I knew 4 years ago wouldn't have touched this, but if the news can be trusted, you might have changed, if you don't mind my saying so.
Where?
Klausner hesitated. The job is in Syria.
Court faked a little chuckle.
No thanks. The Free Syrian Army rebels are floundering. I'm not going to be the last rat to jump onto that ship before it goes down.
Klausner waved a hand in the air.
No, not the FSA. Not the Kurds or the Turks or the Americans or the Iraqis, he shrugged. This is work for the other guys.
Court nodded slowly.
I see.
I have heard all about your moral code. I'm sure that's cost your handlers a mint in the past. If you do the job in Caracas, it might align more with your sense of right and...
I'll work for the Syrian regime. I don't give a shit. Not anymore.
Klausner scratched his snow-white hair.
I'd love to hear the story about what turned you into a black hat.
The room remained silent, and Klausner took the hint quickly. He said,
Never mind then.
Tell me about the job.
You'd be working with a militia.
A militia?
Conventional wisdom in the West is that Azam runs his military. That's a fable. The Syrian regime is no longer a true centralized state. It's a union of warlords, with a warlord politician at its center. In fact, it is very fractured, very tribal down there. A lot of different militias, offshoots of the military, all under the Azam regime coalition. And they fight among themselves as well. One of the most corrupt nations on Earth, because Azam has to let all these warlords and chieftains rape the nation economically, so they will continue to give him their support. I've been there 3 times in the past 3 years, and I can tell you, it's a crazy place full of crazy people. Militias aligned with the regime, but also affiliated with organized crime. And now you add in the Iranians and the Russians running around like they own the place, he sniffed. Regular civilians are caught in the middle.
If the Russians are there, why are the militias hiring labor from you?
The Russians are in the air, conducting special operations in the countryside, that sort of thing. They have Chechen and Ingush Muslim special forces down there as well. But they are on their own. Not folded in with the locals that support Azam. The militias are all trying to professionalize so they can retain some power when the war ends. The Sunnis are helping Azam now, but the fight will really be on when the rebels die off and ISIS dies off and the foreign enemies of Azam give up.
Court feigned casualness in his next question.
Who's the client?
You'd be working for one of the roughest of all the regime-aligned units down there. They are called Liwa Sakur al-Sahara. Heard of them?
Acid fired into Court's stomach now, but he didn't even blink.
The Desert Hawks Brigade.
The German grinned yet again.
You are a pro, Violeta. Of course you know all the players, even in that quagmire. I have 43 contractors positioned there right now at different bases for the Hawks, and there's something like a dozen different PMCs plying their trade down there. With the other groups. Most of what my boys do is training, but there is extracurricular work that comes up. What the Desert Hawks Brigade have my guys doing is after hours. It's shit the fucking Chechens wouldn't even touch.
Court felt unease in the pit of his stomach, but he didn't let on. He feigned thinking it over, then said,
This will do. I need to get to a place where I won't be tracked.
Well... You can't get much more off-grid than a free fire zone in the Middle East. You want the job? It's yours.
Court breathed slowly, careful not to give off any cues as to his true feelings.
I'm in.
Sehr gut, Klausner said with a nod. An Aussie guy working at the Hawks Brigade base in Babila near Damascus just got a kneecap shot off in an ISIS attack on his convoy on Monday. And I had a guy ready to replace him going down tomorrow. I can bump him and send you instead, if you like. Or, we have a couple of openings at other bases around the country. But I figured you'd rather be near civilization.
Damascus will do fine. I appreciate it.
It was better than fine. Court had been prepared to ask point blank to be stationed near the capital in the event he was being sent to some backwater. He couldn't believe his good fortune. Klausner looked at his watch.
Good. I have to get my people to work on your papers all night, but we can do it. You'll fly from Munich to Beirut in the morning. There, we have an arrangement with a charter airline that will do the short hop up to Latakia. It's on the Syrian coast, and the airbase there is controlled by the Russian Air Force, so we don't violate the no-fly zones in the interior.
Klausner winked now.
Hate to have you blown out of the sky on the way in. Anyway, the bad news about the Damascus base is that to get there, you'll have to truck across country. And it's not exactly the most peaceful drive these days. Another military company lost a couple guys on the highway recently, but it's nothing a man like you hasn't seen before.
I'll be fine, Kort said. But he was already second-guessing this surefire way of his to infiltrate Syria. Klausner shrugged.
I'd be a son of a bitch if I didn't fill you in about the loss rates. They are high. But I guess you've experienced worse in other theaters. Tell me. Let me put it this way. I've been sending operators into Damascus for 3 years, and in that time, 8 out of 10 of my guys have made it out in one piece.
Terrific, Kort thought. His cover identity had a built-in 20% casualty rate. He was even less optimistic about the chances of his actual operation, which would no doubt be several orders of magnitude more dangerous. Klausner stood and crossed the room over to Kort now. The big man kept his hands away from his body, and Kort was sure this was to keep his dangerous visitor at ease, but it made Kort worry that Klausner was going to try to get him in a bear hug. Instead, he stopped a few steps away from Kort by the wall.
Normally, there would be a physical, but you look pretty good to me. Have to ask, though. You aren't doing any drugs, are you?
No drugs. Klausner scanned Kort up and down like he was livestock at a sale. After a few seconds, he said,
You're different, not physically. I just mean, taking this job, knowing you'll be working for the Azam regime. You're sure you're not on something?
Kort said, Look me over like a mule, but you aren't getting blood or DNA.
God, no. Of course not. I understand you are a different case, a damned celebrity, and you will be treated as such.
He raised his eyebrows as a new thought came to him.
I'd like to exploit this financially. Tell the Syrians you are special, require special rates.
No, Kort said with authority. I don't want to stick out. Especially not down there. Klausner waved a hand through the air.
The gray man, I get it. Forget I mentioned it. The guy I'm bumping to send you down, he's Canadian. You'll take his documents, assume his identity.
Klausner shrugged again.
It's a fake name anyway. All my guys use pseudonyms on their ops, safer for everybody. I'll have my people come here tonight and get your picture to match it to the docs.
I'll get more papers from my Canadian contractor and send him to Caracas.
Klausner shrugged.
He was a coward anyway. Didn't want to go to Syria.
Works for me. Klausner reached out and shook Kort's hand.
Some motherfucking gray man,
he said, still marveling over the fact that the legend was here in his presence. Kort lay folded in a small closet in a guest room of Klausner's penthouse apartment, the door cracked and his pistol by his side. He'd unmade the bed, then turned on the light in the bathroom and closed the door. If anyone came into his room tonight, they'd think they'd caught him up and taking a piss, and this would buy him some time to mount a counterattack. He stared at the dark ceiling, thinking about the operation to come. He'd have to be in a car on the way to the airport in less than 4 hours, but for right now, his nerves kept him awake. So far, everything was proceeding according to plan. He'd known for a long time that Lars Klausner was running mercs into Syria, and making a small fortune doing it. He'd also been reasonably sure Lars wouldn't pass up the opportunity to send him down if given the chance to do so. Kort had hoped he'd be on his way in 2 or 3 days, but was astonished to find out he'd be getting on a plane within 8 hours. It didn't give him much time to study maps, but the quick infiltration into Syria was one of the first good things that had happened for the chances of little Jamal Medina in the past 3 days. So he told himself he should just try to relax and go with the flow, up until the moment when he had to break his cover legend and make a run for the kid. Court wondered about the job ahead. Not the kidnapping of the child. Instead, he speculated about what he might have to do as a contracted member of a Syrian regime.